They began laying out the schematics for the intricate gemstone-changing device that let her chair have such smooth flight. That included the specifics of the gravity and ocean wave-based propellant types, both of which were far more efficient than simply having a track of Chulls move your ship. So some of this we've seen before, and some of this we have not.
Welcome back to Following Noadon, Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 261, and we are in interludes 15, 16, through chapter 104 of Wind and Truth, into day 9. Elliot, how are you?
I am doing well. Day 9, Wind and Truth. Hard to believe we are this far. We still have a ways to go. But we've come pretty far. You've handed me the mic, so I'm gonna complain about something a little bit.
Wow.
Uh-oh.
I'm sorry.
We haven't even acknowledged the Tanavas in the room yet, but go ahead.
No. Well, Tanavas is part of the problem here, actually. So I've talked, it was probably 5 or 6 episodes ago now, how this book, I think more than any other Sanderson book I've read yet, suffers noticeably from reading it slowly. And I think we've hit the peak of that yet here in these chapters. I was going through these chapters, and I'll be honest, getting a little bit lost in the number of POV switches. So I tallied it up, and from page 955 to 1,000, so 45 pages, we cover 7 chapters, if you count the interludes, and those 7 chapters have no less than 10 different point of views that do not repeat at any point. And all 10 of those POVs are pretty much different plot lines. They are not intersecting at all. And that is a lot to wrestle with when you are reading this book at the slow pace that we are reading it. I think if you're reading this entire book in a weekend, that probably doesn't bother you because it was only 45 minutes to an hour ago that you last saw Dalinar or Zeth. But for me, it's been 2.5 weeks since I've seen Zeth, and I'm trying to keep track of what else going on in his storyline here with 10 different POVs in 45 pages of the book. Is anyone else wrestling with this? It's causing me a little bit of trouble.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to dock you back down to 9 because you're counting Rissen and interludes don't really count. So,
but they do, though. We spend a whole like 8 chapters with 8 pages with Rissen.
No.
In earlier
the Terravision interludes count, but Rissen's interlude does not count.
No, she's talking with Hoid about Dawn Shards. That is 100% relevant to our story. It is not Ishik in the Pure Lake.
Well, maybe this interlude does count, but most interludes don't count.
I was going to say, Trevor, I would absolutely grant you that in prior books.
Yeah.
Especially like The Way of Kings, Words of Radiance.
You might be
those
right.
Books, interludes were like crazy. You don't even need to know the context. You'll figure out the context one day later. These are relevant. Zyle, Lift, like Rissen, Kalak, whatever, all the stuff earlier in the book.
Yeah.
They're all relevant in this book, I think. There's probably, you could maybe pick one out that isn't or something, but even like the what we get with
the Eerie.
It's not the Azish, right? The Eerie, yes. Even that is, I think, fully relevant. Maybe a little less so, but anyways, I think they do count. But I have to say, Elliot, I haven't felt the same whiplash. It is funny though, because each week I'm like, all right, who are the characters I get to see this week? Am I going to see Zeth and Kaladin, or am I going to see Dalinar and Shallan? Like, what's the flavor of the week this time? And that's probably not the case for most readers who are just going through the book. They're probably like, it's everyone all the time, all at once. Which is different.
I'm dreading when we get to the end of this book and we're going to have to score it, to rank it, because I don't know whether this is something that I should fairly like include in my rankings of this book or not, because I don't think the book is intended to be read over 9 months like we are reading it. And so if you read the book the way it's intended to be read over the course of a week, like a month, probably max, this is probably not an issue. But when you stretch it out over 9 months, it is an issue. Anyway, that's enough of me rambling. Paul, how are you?
I'm great.
Might be the latest we've ever got to a Paul introduction.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so I'll take my time here. I'll make up for it. No, I'm joking. Awesome. Starting day 9, I haven't looked at my physical book yet, but I'm assuming that our little arch is just in shambles and rubble at this point. I haven't looked, but I want to.
Something to say about that once you're done. Go ahead.
Okay. So excited. We get a Tanavast point of view, and I am over the moon. For one, my bingo board. For two, I picked that as a wish list. Not necessarily. Well, I did think it would happen, but largely it was a wish list item for me. So as soon as we started day 9, and Tanavast was in the point of view list, I could have just stopped there. I didn't even have to keep going, but I did, and I loved it all. And so I'm over the moon this week. I'm super excited. Just keeps going. Dawn Shard Talk and the Dawn Interludes. Also, a Sleepless in actual Stormlight Archive, not novella, not the novellas between.
Right.
Big week for Paul. Cannot wait to talk all the way through this. So yes, I am doing really well this week. I'm excited.
Okay. So with your arches for day 9, you had a question about that. I also had a question about that. In our podcast discussion, shout out to Gazeboist and Yoslo in our podcast discussion. I was requested by Gazeboist for our last episode, and I'll quote you here. Gazebo says, I think it would be really cool to end episode 260, which was last week, looking at, not reading, just looking at the first page of chapter 100. If it'd be possible to do that with scheduling, blah, 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 that'd be great. And I was like, okay, I'd already assigned you guys the chapter splits for this week. So that wasn't really feasible. However, I hadn't read it yet. I hadn't read chapter 100 when he said this yet. So I was like, yeah, that's not really feasible. I'll just go look at the page right now and see what he's talking about. And I flipped to chapter 100 thinking to myself, okay, there's some chapter header thing that's going to blow my mind. This is really cool. Like the arches are going to be like forming into spikes from Odium's crown or something weird. Oh no. That's not what they're talking about at all. They're talking about, and I skip the point of view page for day 9 that says Tanavast on it, and to go look at chapter 100. And at this point on my reading, I'm like just starting the interludes or something. So I go to chapter 100, and it says God or whatever the title of the chapter is 10,000 years ago. And I'm like, whoa, whoa. So Gazeboist, there's your reaction. I did have a nice full like jaw drop reaction to it. Not the same one that Yoslo had when he says that the audiobook experience is very different when you have Michael Kramer saying God or whatever as you're entering day 9. So
I wanted to mention that Michael Kramer, as everyone knows, anyone who's even heard some of the audiobook, at least clips of it, knows Michael Kramer and Kate Redding do a fantastic job with this. But this chapter and these point of views are, I have chill bumps right now. Like, you can't see it, but like, I'm getting chills. It does such an impeccable job. So well done conveying this. It's just got an amazing blessing of a voice and well practiced with it. Like, It's so good. If you've been reading just the books, go listen to chapter 100, or I anticipate there's going to be more also. There's other Tannevest point of views, but go listen to these. He does an amazing job with this. It's just like, it's so good.
All right, Elliot, back to your point of view complaint that you had to start the episode. How would you like to be Michael Kramer and 5,000 pages into a series, and you have to come up with another voice introed at the 11th hour in Wind and Truth?
With a similar like demographic, for lack of a better word, to other characters. Like, we've had other large, godly, epic voice characters with Odium, right, and the Stormfather, and now he's got to come up with another one slightly distinct enough to be recognizable as Tannevast.
I agree. I have no idea how he does it. And to be fair, it is a lot of that just large, big, booming, deific voice that he's going for. He does such a great job of it. And I will say, I also recognize that I'm going into this chapter titled, after hearing Tannevast POV, titled God, and we're getting this point of view, so everything to me was just like amazing. Like, didn't even matter what it said. Like, I'm in. I want to know what's happening. I want to know what we're gonna learn. So I was all in. And then Michael Kramer just had to do his thing.
Would you say you were on cloud 9 for the start of day 9?
Yes, I would, Trevor. Thank you for pointing that out. I would.
You're welcome. Okay, Elliot, how about a chapter summary for Interlude 15, 16, chapters 100 through 104?
Yeah, I'm going to hit this really fast because we've already alluded to like at least half of this. Interlude 15 is a Risen point of view, and she has her Dawn Shard, and she encounters another Dawn Shard wielder in Hoid and has a interesting interaction there with him, and the Kremlin sleepless dudes show up and have a chat there too. Interlude 16 is yet another one pager Odium perspective as he's wrestling with the events going on. Chapter 100, which I'd like to point out. So we talked about, it's the Tannevast honor, the god of the world kind of thing. What's our magical number on this world? It's 10.
10
brings us to chapter 100, the perfect set of perfect numbers. And I thought that was cool. Anyway, Tannevast's point of view as he's discovering Roshar, cultivation comes to join him. They're exploring. Humans are over there. There's another weird planet over there. What's going on here? Chapter 101, Venli for a brief second. Not a whole lot there as she's trying to figure out what they're going to do in response to the ultimatum they've been given by L. Jumps over to Navani, though, who is living through a vision flashback of her own past as she's wrestling with tough things. I think Odium's throwing some tests, some torture her way of having to relive unpleasant memories. This one involves Gavilar, especially. Chapter 102 is Zeth flashback. He goes to assassinate Posen, one of the other honor bearers, and ends up having a chat with Sivvy and Posen as they decide, what are we supposed to do about this? What has even happened around us with this unmade? Chapter 103 is present day Kaladin and Zeth as Kaladin is cooking carrots for breakfast and talking with the wind about Nail for probably the fourth or fifth time. And then second half of chapter 103 is Sigzil getting some help from Lopin, who arrives on the scene, but still they're short of Stormlight. What are we going to do? We need a plan. Venli appears right at the very end, so obviously we're going to go somewhere with Sigzil and Venli going forward. Chapter 104 is another Tannevast chapter, and this one has Tannevast going head-to-head with Raze as they, not quite battle necessarily, but have conflict. We'll just say that. And I think that'll do it for the summary.
All right, let's go ahead and get it out of the way now. Paul, do you have an announcement to make about the Tannevast point of view?
Yes, it was on my bingo board, and very excited about that. The sad thing about it is it's the bottom right corner, and I have nothing in that column and nothing in that row.
Ooh, bummer.
So, but it's on my bingo board and I will take it and I'm thrilled. This was one of those that I most wanted to happen that was on my bingo board, less than it being a prediction of what I think might happen. I really wanted to see a Tarnovest point of view. So here we are.
Do you have two words for these chapters, Paul?
I do. Two very easy words. A lot of things happen in this chapter, so I couldn't really come up with words to really summarize it. But my two words are Dawn Shard Alert. We'll talk about this. Dawn Shard Alert. Rissen's entered the fray. We'll discuss in a little bit.
I mean, entered. She's about to just like turn tail and run, though. That was the whole.
She's in the book. We're getting her point of view. Okay, yes. We get to talk about it. We get new information.
True. Elliot, do you have two words?
Dissonance and deception. I picked dissonance for the interaction we're seeing between Tarnovest and the Power of Honor, which they are not fully aligned, which continues to feed this whole honor acting not quite so honorably. There's a few mentions in here of the power squirming at that decision, and Tana was like, no, I'm in charge here. You be quiet. And I maybe a better word actually for me to pick, though, would have been discord, which has some other Cosmere connotations that
I
won't mention because we don't really need to get into that now.
Correct.
And my other word is deception. For one little word, one little line that Sivvy actually says as she's talking to Zeth, which I want to ask you guys about because it has me completely puzzled. And she's talking about deception, but we'll get there.
All right. Without further ado, Interlude 15, Rissen is in some sort of merchant discussion with some people in your Thiru. Hoid walks in, says, who the heck are you? Rissen says, I'm Rissen, and this is my sleepless buddy. And then they reveal that Hoid currently has a Dawn Shard that he previously had and then gave up and then went back to retrieve. So, yeah. And then Rissen says, like, I've got an idea. Maybe I need to, like, leave or something with my ship or something like that. And then the scene ends.
Well, and before that, the two of them like just about explode the planet or something.
Yeah.
Apparently kind of, you're not supposed to have two Dawn Shards in a room together.
Yeah.
They talk about that a little bit. I was curious to know what y'all thought. They say something along the lines of, I don't remember exactly, but yeah, essentially they can't be together. The powers are too strong or effective or something that they can't just be side by side, but they come to some level of it is okay, right? Because they haven't exploded the planet. But yeah, were y'all like really shook that this person with a Dawn Shard just kind of strolls up? We just kind of get this. Like, that was crazy to me. We see Rissen. We know she has a Dawn Shard. Cool. Good. I want to learn more. But then we see her, and she's like, oh, yeah, by the way, we picked up this guy. Came out of nowhere. Said, hey, I have a Dawn Shard, too. That was like, whoa, okay, this book is like...
Well, you're talking about Hoid?
Hoid's
the other guy with the Dawn Shard.
Okay, but he's under some weird alias or whatever, right?
Yes, he's dressed as Galinar and walks in.
Gotcha. Okay, that's what was like crazy to me at first. You know, and then it is Hoid, which is fine. I guess I feel really dumb now. I thought it was not Hoid. I thought this other guy. That's what's warranting my reaction. Like, that's why I'm like, Hoid. This is insane. Okay.
Well, because
I was like, now we have track of three. I was going all sorts of places with this.
No.
I obviously missed something big.
So Hoid walks in, says, who the heck are you, to Rissen? Kremling Man, Mr. Kremling Man, shout out, forms himself and says, yo, this is Rissen. She's got our Dawn Shard. Everything's fine. And Mr. Cunningman turns to Rissen and says, the reason he knows is because he used to have a Donchard. And Rissen says, he currently has a Donchard. I can feel it. Like, we're about to, like, push each other cosmically apart. And then Mr. Cunningman turns around and says, you don't have a Donchard, do you? You wouldn't be that stupid. And then Hoid says, yeah, about that. That's how the scene goes.
Other side note, I thought I had. So I'm assuming everyone listening right now has read the novellas. It's read Edge Dancer and Donchard. And I understand that those are very important books, especially with this, right? But I was under the impression you don't have to read them, but you should. You absolutely would recommend, highly recommend you have to read these books before continuing on in Stormlight. Do you think there are people reading this who didn't read either of those? And are they just
absolutely
enormously confused, thinking that this is a like a good old Way of Kings interlude where you're dropped some other place with some foreign things and have no idea what's going on?
Yes, that absolutely is the case with someone. I don't think they're listening to this podcast, though, if they haven't read Donchard. However, with the extreme lack of Donchards in our book up until Interlude 15, I think this might be a back half thing. Are we just like talking, like sprinkling in Donchards to get us comfortable for book 6? Or are we going to shift it into high gear and Hoid and Rissen are going to 2v1 Odium in 100 pages?
That was my takeaway from this chapter was this is our Donchard moment for this book. Yeah. And we're probably not getting him again through the end of this book.
That's what the conclusion I came to as well.
I would agree. I would certainly agree. There's no time for this to be. It would even feel a bit weird and out of place if start of day 9, after everything that's happened, then it's like, oh, hey, we found the key. It's this Dawn Shard. Here, Rissen, you're our champion. And then she defeats Odium. La, la, la. We survive. That would be really a bit brutal.
Yeah.
I think out of... Dawn Shards have always been in my mind, like, as we've read this book, but they have not been in our story. So I think this is certainly setting up for back half. I desperately want to see the Dawn Shards, though. I desperately want to know more. So I will be patient. I will wait.
Rissen also revealed to us, I don't know if this was common knowledge or not, that the three other Dawn Shards are not even on Roshar, or at least they're not supposed to be. That there's the one Dawn Shard here on Roshar that we already went and grabbed in Dawn Shard. And the other three are not supposed to be here at all. That's not the impression I had going into Wind and Truth. I thought we were going to go collect some Infinity Stones and go fight Odium with our four Dawn Shards, but I guess not. Were you guys under the same influence or not?
Well, I realized I was greatly mistaken in that I thought that this was someone else with the Dawn Shard, and we now knew of three that we had.
Okay.
And if we have three out of four, I feel like that's very different than two out of four, given the point we are at in our story.
It's 25% different.
It is. It's quite a big difference, actually. Statistically important. So I thought wrong. I was very incorrect, and that's been shattered a bit right here as we've spoken. I don't know. It doesn't feel like it would be. It would certainly not have the significance I think it deserves in this book, because we haven't really covered Dawn Shards other than in the novella. So if that came up to be the crux of this book, it would be. Anyone who did not read it would feel super gypped. Anyone who's not read Dawn Shard would be like, what? This makes no sense. This just came out of nowhere. So I certainly think it's going to be a later thing, back half Stormlight, back half Cosmere. But as far as I will say I did expect Risen to have some more relevance in our story. So I haven't wanted for it to be like, yeah, we get our Risen mention and the Dawnshard mention here, then peace out, we'll see you next book. I've wanted more relevance. I've wanted more relevance with that and with Cheery Cheery. And we get, I feel like Cheery Cheery's highlight reel was all in Oathbringer, and then that's it. And I'm kind of wanting some more relevance there, but there's so much going on. I don't know how you do it. So as I said, I will be patient. I will wait, because I have full confidence that those moments are coming one day.
You might be waiting quite a while, and
I will be waiting quite a while. I'm going to have to really practice that patience I just mentioned.
All right, Elliot, you teased an engineering explanation.
Yes. All this Dawnshard chat. Yes, yes. Super cool, super cool. But Risen's floating chair. Actually cool. And there's a little bit of information in here in this chapter that the chair's not super new, right? We've actually seen this. We spent some time in Dawnshard, I think, working on this chair and getting it working. She has her chair again here, and they're talking about the patents that they're trying to get signatures on for this chair. And she's like super enhanced the chair so it can do a lot more things than it did before, and it can move smoothly in all different directions. And there's a brief explanation for how they're doing this, like super brief, one sentence. But it got my head spinning, and I had to draw some things up in PowerPoint. So go ahead and open the spoiler image. We'll bring it on the screen now for our YouTube watchers, and I'll post this also in our Discord when this episode goes live. So if you're listening to us, recommend going and trying to find this image somewhere, either on YouTube or from our Discord, because what I'm about to talk about for a few minutes here is not going to make a whole lot of sense if you're not looking at this image here, but I'll do my best. Okay, there's a lot here, so I'm going to talk you through it all of what is going on. I found some cute little art of Risen there in her chair. This art is by Ayala Shapiro. And so I grab this as our little visual here. So the bit of information that we get in the chapter is this. She's explaining, oh yeah, I've superpowered my chair. Isn't it awesome? Let's see. They began laying out the schematics for the intricate gemstone changing device that let her chair have such smooth flight. That included the specifics of the gravity and ocean wave based propellant types, both of which were far more efficient than simply having a track of chulls move your ship. So some of this we've seen before, and some of this we have not. I've got Risen in the middle there. Right next to her, I've got a coordinate frame, X, Y, and Z axes. So Z is up, X is left and right, Y is forward and back from Risen's perspective, essentially. Basic movements we've seen before. This goes all the way back to the Iron Man gauntlet that Kaladin had. If you remember from Rhythm of War, he was able to point that in different directions and shoot off in that way. We talk about then this concept of like weights in a shaft. So to simply move up and down, an easy way we could do that is we can conjoin fabrials, one of which is tied to a weight on a pulley in a shaft, and you just activate the lowering of that weight down the shaft, and you've got a reverse conjoined fabrial that then lifts you up in the air. You guys remember all that?
Yes.
Just a little bit. So my purple arrows there kind of tie you to that. If you want to go up and down, you can just have these weights in a shaft that go up and down. Left and right, though, a little trickier, especially if you want to do some kind of fine-tuned movements. And she specifically mentions ocean power. Well, she says wave, ocean wave-based propellant types. And I had to scratch my head a little bit on this for how exactly are they doing this? Waves are not the most like consistent of movements. They kind of roll, they kind of sway back and forth. So if you want like a nice smooth move your chair very carefully and smoothly across the floor, waves are not the first thing I thought of. But then I thought of, in our real world, we do have tidal powered electric generators. Just like you can actually have, that there is such a thing as a gravity battery I think I talked about that briefly once in the past, how the weights going up and down to store electric energy is a thing. You can also use the ocean. The tide comes in and out fairly predictably. And so you can have underwater turbines, basically, that as the water comes in and goes out is driving those turbines to generate electricity. So I thought about something maybe along those lines, as if she's got fabrials that are either floating on top of the water or maybe even underneath the water, like kind of tied to a track that's on the ocean floor, actually. As the waves come in, as the tide is coming in and out, you can get different X and Y lateral movements out of that that you could tie to your chair. So my X-axis is orange. I've tied those to kind of a left and right tides. I should say on the left side of my screen here, I thought about this as looking down on an island, which conveniently Thalina is an island, Thalen Island. So if you had these devices kind of scattered around your island in all directions, as the tide comes in, you can see my solid arrows show the tide coming in from kind of all directions. So if you had a bunch of different fabrials all in different locations, as the tide's coming in, you've got fabrials that are moving in each of kind of those four different directions. So you could program into your fabrial here, I want to go this way. It senses which of the fabrials in the ocean is moving at that direction at that time and pairs those two to move that way. And then when the tide goes out, you're going the other way, but you've got them on kind of all four sides. So again, you're getting all four of those directions that you could tie to. So either floating on the ocean, her thing says ocean wave. Waves kind of, I don't know, I don't get smooth motions out of waves, but I thought that was potentially one way that she's doing this, is a combination of the shaft weights going up and down with gravity and like the tides coming in and out for lateral directions. There's more to this, but I'll stop there. You guys got any questions? Are you confused at any point on this?
I'm tracking. What I will say, my only complaint is canonically, we are 12 days removed from Kaladin's Iron Man Gauntlet. There is no way that Rissen and her Thalen merchant guys have set this up in 12 days. Just saying.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that. There's one other bit here, and there's actually some problems with this too. Problem number one is actually something that came up a long, long time ago when we were talking about span reads, maybe even like the very first thing that I sketched up as one of these. You start to have problems with span reads, like, you know, I'm moving my pen this way and your pen is moving the exact same way. You get problems because the Earth or the planet Roshar is round. So me over here making those movements is not the exact movements that if you're, you know, 300 miles around the curvature of Roshar, it's actually slightly different. There's ways they might have fixed that. You have the same problem here. If Rissen is in Urethiru and all these fabrials that are around Thalen Island are kind of farther away, the movements don't quite line up. She's probably solved that somehow. There's a second part of this, last part, and then we'll get off of this. I had to bring in some math equations, right? Because math is cool.
Of course.
Physics.
Of course.
She makes another claim. Not only has she gotten these super efficient, smooth movements, she also drops that she's achieved a top speed of her seat of 73 knots.
Woo! She's speeding.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about how fast that is here in a second. Yes, that is crazy fast. And the ocean waves do not move that fast that I'm aware of. I don't think there's any wave out there moving 73 knots. Maybe if there's a nautical person out there who knows I'm wrong, please chime in. I would love to know that. I think of waves as moving much slower. But so I don't think the ocean could be powering that unless she's got some other crazy way to like multiply that force and speed. However, her heavy weights in the chasm in the tunnel, if you just drop one of those, that could get going pretty fast. So I kind of got wondering, okay, well, how fast? If I take a big rock and I hook it to the end of a pulley there and I drop it, the fastest it's going to go is terminal velocity. So if you drop a weight, it's getting pulled by gravity, but it's got the resistance of air that it's falling through. It's going to eventually reach an equilibrium, which is the fastest speed that an object can fall at. Well, there's an equation for this, and it's in the bottom right of my little graphic here. It's the terminal velocity equation. It's not that complicated. There's only four or five different elements that you need to know in order to calculate that. And we can at least kind of assume enough of these elements to make this calculation. So I did. On the bottom part of this graph, of this image, you can see some numbers that I assumed and then made the calculation to see how it would compare to this claim of 73 knots. So what I assumed was that her rock or concrete or whatever she's got that she's tied to the end of this weight is about 70 kilograms, which is about like 150 pounds. So it's like it's a big rock. Surface area is important here. I assumed a half a meter squared, which would be about like 2 feet by 2 feet, like 2 feet down one side, 2 feet down another. So again, think like big boulder, not like giant boulder. If you're really strong, you can pick this thing up. Drag coefficient is how pointy it is. If it's super duper pointy, then it's got a really low drag efficient. If it's super duper flat, it's got a really high drag coefficient. One is the highest. So it's kind of a 0 to 1 kind of thing. I assume that this thing is perfectly flat. It is blunt. It is not pointy at all. It's not aerodynamic. Drag coefficient is the worst possible, 1.0. Gravity on Roshar, this is fascinating. We know gravity on Roshar is different than Earth. It's less than. And I don't know where this came from, but somebody over at Coppermind has claimed that the gravity on Roshar is exactly 6.86 meters per second squared. So I'm assuming that Coppermind is right, and I grabbed that.
That's because it's a... The Skadriel is 1.0... And Roshar is a 1.3.
Well, I think it's like it's 70%-ish, I think, of Earth gravity.
You're right. You're right. It's the other direction. So yeah, it's 0.7.
Yeah. So I plug that in, gravity in the acceleration of gravity on Roshar. I assume that the density of the air is the same as Earth at sea level, which that's a pretty big assumption, but I don't really have anything else to go off of necessarily. It might be less because the gravity on Roshar is less, but I don't want to mess around with that too much. I don't think it changes the math too much, but 1.225 kilograms per meter cubed is the density of air on Earth at sea level. And then we plug all that into the equation and it will spit out a terminal velocity. The answer you get when you plug all that in is 39.6 meters per second, which equates to 77 knots, which if you think in miles per hour, like I do, is 89 miles per hour. So if the fastest her block can fall in the tunnel is 77 knots, there's going to be some losses here. This is all pretty ideal. So yeah, 73 knots to me seems right about spot on.
Why would you ever want to go 73 knots in a chair?
Why would you not?
That's it's like my a
jet
question.
Ski jetpack. Like, let's go. Strap me in.
Okay, you smack a wall, you are not walking away from it. You need an airbag.
That's true. Okay. Oh, yeah, true. Safety.
Yeah, hopefully they got seatbelts or something, you know. Okay, so if you're dropping this weight, did I miss something? Is it what you were talking about of kind of being lowered and raised? Or is it like you drop and then you hit the ocean and you're going 73 knots and you just stop? You just smack, fly out of you, like... fly off. What's the deceleration process here? Do you just slow it down?
It's probably going to be rough unless she's got some fancy like braking system on this. So if you just all out drop that weight, yeah, it's going to drop. And then if it hits the bottom of your shaft that you've got, yeah, you're just going to come like instantly to a stop. And that is going to be, yeah, if you don't have airbags on this thing, you're just going to like be dead.
So you create an amusement park with a human slingshot. And you go, zoop, and the chair stops and you go, wee.
Yeah. Or you'd have to have some like braking system on this pulley that's pulling the weight so that you can slowly slow down your weight so it doesn't go from 89 miles an hour to zero in a split second so you don't just die. Although I think it does say in the book when she says that her chair goes 73 knots, that she specifically says that she was not in the seat at the time when it went 73.
Yes. Knots. My brain is at think of the amusement parks that Wayne would design on Skadriel with this technology. Yes.
Roller coasters.
What he would invent with some lashings technology here. Okay, thank you for that, Elliot. That was very nice. Well, you have outdone yourself once again on your visuals here. So thank you.
This one was a little math and physics heavy, so I apologize for that.
Anything else on Interlude 15? Interlude 16. Odium doesn't know where Dalinar went. Anything else?
Yes. Yes. Okay. No, no. Do not dismiss this. It is one page, but there is one line on this one page that has me curious. Yeah. Dalinar disappears. Odium's confused. Okay. Yada, yada. Like almost the very last line says this. The power of honor had been too long without a host. It was becoming dangerous. It was becoming, in italics, alive. Is this simple? And by alive, he just means getting ready to bond someone again. Or are we talking like the investiture itself becoming its own new entity without a vessel?
Yeah. So the reason why this didn't shock my world is because I've sat in on plenty of Sanderson Q&As where he answers this exact question. I didn't think we'd see it in Wind and Truth, but you're absolutely correct. Sanderson's been asked, okay, because Spren are just investiture that's kind of had its own intent and now is coalescing around, can that happen to a shard? He has absolutely answered yes multiple times. I've seen it in person, him answer yes, and the whole crowd goes, ooh. Now, I did not expect this to happen to Honor. You're right. That's quite terrifying that Honor would grow some legs, stand up, and start walking around. Woo.
Which, I mean, this even takes me to places like, I assume the final boss of this book is Odium. It's Dalinar versus Odium here at the end. I could see this being like, hang on a second. Odium coalesces into a thing, decides that every single thing here is not honorable, and just starts rampaging. And actually, we need Odium's help to stop the big old honor monster that is wrecking the world.
I wish that's where my brain went. Rebuttal you, but I don't think I can.
I just think I love it. I absolutely love the theory. I think we've passed the we're going to end up working with Honor. Sorry, we're going to end up working with Odium stage. But who knows? TBD, we still have a quite impactful amount of book left.
We've talked about the Elden Ring influences on this book already. Elden Ring, you go fight a boss, but then that boss like dies, and then there's a boss behind the boss, and you use the sword that you just go picked up to go fight Millennia or whatever her name is. I haven't played Elden Ring. I could absolutely see some sort of. My brain is at the whole honor is deadline. What if honor not being dead at the end of last book, so long as he lives in the hearts of men, what if that like woke up the honor ogre? For lack of a better term.
Interesting.
Like honor's been dead for as long as people have thought honor was dead. But now that people think that honor's not dead and going to come kill everybody. I don't know if this is where this book's going, but I could feasibly see it.
We don't have a whole lot of pages left to introduce what would kind of be maybe a new villain. But I don't know. We could be in for a shock day 10.
If I will say this, if Honor does turn out to be a full-on villain and attack our heroes, I will be upset. I've been a big Honor Shard fan for a long time. I've got no problem with skeletons in Honor's closet, but we'll see if it pans out that way and how it's done, but I might have an issue. Anything else?
No, that was it.
All right. Speaking of honor, we get the flashback chapter to end all flashback chapters. 10,000 years ago to open day 9, chapter 100. And Tanavast is like speaking to the reader via like diary. Is there some sort of like technical point of view term for this? He's honors like speaking to the audience.
I mean, it's just monologue, right? It's a Shakespearean tool where the single character gets on the stage and monologues at the audience.
Okay. Okay. Because, yeah, he...
And
go ahead.
And am I tracking correctly? Do you guys think go this way too? We just left Dalinar where he found the Stormfather and was like, show me. Oh, you're going to hate me. I can't show me. And then this is what we get next. So is this what the Stormfather is showing Dalinar?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Dalinar is seeing what we are seeing here as far as I know.
That's what I thought was going on, but I'm glad you're thinking that too.
Two big reveals in this chapter. We have Tanavast and Corvellium prearranged this meetup on Roshar. That before Aiden Alsium did his Aiden Alsium stuff and splintered, shattered, whatever you want to call it, they said, we're going to go meet up, despite making promises. Now that makes me think, did Tanavast get hosed with the honor shard? And because he picked up the honor shard and then does this prearranged meetup, even though he said he wouldn't, was it doomed from the start? Or did he just get stuck with the honor shard and now his shard doesn't like him? Because Elliot, you mentioned this in the summary, honor and Tanavast in both of these chapters, 100 and 104, honor is like smashing its head against Tanavast and saying, you broke an oath, you're breaking oaths, like stop doing this, you're a terrible person. And Tanavast is like saying, get in line, I'm the god, blah, blah, blah. I'm wondering if he set up this meeting with Tanavast or with Corvellium, his lover, before he got dealt honor. What does that matter? Did he just get hosed with grabbing the honor stick and now his shard hates him?
Maybe.
Did they get a choice? First come, first serve? Seniority?
Luck of the draw? I don't know. But yeah, Tanavast, that was kind of my biggest takeaway from this chapter, is that Tanavast and Power of Honor are not quite on the same page all the way since the beginning. And yeah. I think we're going to keep exploring this because it comes up in chapter 104 as well. Tanavast keeps breaking oaths, even if they're minor or small or larger ones. And there's a dissonance. There's a discord happening.
Stop using that word. My brain jumps the scabbard when you use that word.
Did it also feel to y'all like Raze was just like a cosmic level third wheel?
Yes.
It was like this like Tanavast and Corvellium Avast just, you know, coordinating. They seem to have quite the relationship. And then they're like, and Raze showed up and just ruined the whole thing, you know.
Correct.
I thought it was quite comical how it was presented. Very funny, but also a bit legitimate. If we didn't have him here, it'd probably be a lot easier to have a happy little Roshar retirement.
Something that, to kind of jump off of that, they mention twice, once in chapter 100 and once in chapter 104, the destruction of ambition. Correct me if I'm wrong. Ambition, yes, is on Threnody. The Threnody shard that blows up and shades everywhere.
What were the two on sale? Devotion.
Devotion and Dominion.
Dominion. So yeah, that has to be Threnody then.
Okay.
So that puts the timeline of Ambition dying almost immediate, because Tanavas shows up on Roshar. He's musing about Braze and Ashen, and I'll get back to that in a second. And at the end of the chapter, they're both Corvellium and Tanavas are like, oh, something just happened. That was bad. And then in 104, it's explained to us that Ambition just died.
Yeah.
I'm now really curious how long Ambition held their shard. Really curious if it was like literally a matter of hours before Odium went after Ambition. Like, that's crazy to me.
I hate to joke about it, but perhaps the shard of Ambition got a little too ambitious.
Ambitious. And, well, and that's what Odium says. And, yeah. Is in 104 is everybody knew at the table that Ambition needed to go. I was just the one that had the courage to do so. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, kind of fair enough. I mean, if you're named Ambition and you expect it not to come after you at some point, then you're pretty much just naive, I think.
I mean, and the other obvious target we also know is a problem in autonomy. I'd be worried about that one from the start. And
right.
Yeah.
All right. The other big reveal in 100 is Tanavas has like a 2-paragraph muse about Braze. Braze has this like metal core to the cold planet, and it attracts investiture. That's really cool, but I'm gonna go hang out on Roshar for now, and I'll go talk about it later. And I'm like, all right, well, hold up, hold up. What is this aluminum, or is this like some sort of metal that we don't know about yet?
Go ahead, Paul, and then I'll talk.
Sorry. I was going to say, I could be totally wrong, but I feel like this isn't the first mention we've had of a metal core to a planet.
You may be right.
And I have wondered what that means for us. Is that something that will be able to be harnessed, like investiture that's able to be harnessed? If so, I anticipate our Ghostbloods will get on that at some point. Other than that, I don't know why this could be important. It could be that it allows various investiture, like on the planet, perhaps to exist. But I'm waiting for why this is relevant. Why are we talking about the core of the planet? I feel like there are bigger matters at hand. But I do, with this being mentioned, I feel like there is going to be relevance. My hunch is that it's going to go with the Ghostbloods in some capacity.
I think some of this is not too much. It's not too surprising. It's not too much new information for me, in that we already know that the Fused are drawn to Braze for some reason. I think this is just kind of adding to the equation that this is part of that reason, that there's a metal core in Braze that draws investiture to itself. So for whatever reason, when the Fused die, their shadows, what are the cognitive shadows, their investiture gets like sucked back to Braze, and they can't get off until certain criteria are met. That'll make sense-ish, kind of. There's probably more to unravel here. But the other...
Is it an investiture magnet and you just can't get off once you're on it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I'm going to say a couple things here that are fairly major spoilers for Sunlit Man. So if you have not read Sunlit Man, skip forward like a minute and a half. We've kind of seen that before in Sunlit Man on Canticle. That planet acts like a magnet. I did a whole engineering diagram drawing thing about, you know, magnets and forces and kind of poles and things like that kind of forcing on there. So I immediately thought of that when he starts talking about Braze.
Agreed. Then in 104, Tanavast like tracks down Odium to Odium's home planet, I think. Anyone catch the name of this planet?
I know what you're talking about, but no, I don't remember what it was.
We probably should have done a spell check on it because it's a weird name. Where did I put it? Oh, it's like Alaswa or Alashwa.
Oh yeah, okay. Alashwa.
Alashwa.
I think is how they say it in the audiobook. And if I'm correct, it's like Odium's little arena to figure out who's the strongest and gets to serve him. Which I was like, dang. Wow. All right. Raze is kind of intense. And so he's got his own little pet world over here, and he like sponsors different nations to go kill other nations, and then, you know, he's like basically training an army world when Tanavast shows up. And then, yeah, Tanavast and Odium hang out for a little bit, and that's the end of 104. Did you guys get anything out of their hangout session?
One little bit that I think is relevant, but again, not maybe too surprising. As Tanavast is leaving, he hears Nail as a child talking with
Maybe
his father, just his family. And they're like, we must resist. Yes, we're going to get squashed by this nation. They're too powerful. They have of some kind. Nail and his people don't have it. And so Tanavast is leaving and he realizes, oh man, these are the honorable people. These are the people who are standing up against the bullies, even when they can't win. You know what? I'm going to give them the power too. So he goes to Nail and that people and says, all right, here you go. Here's the power to fight back.
I feel like
massive war that destroys the planet.
Yeah, I feel like that's quite the reveal that Nail is around now. Like, does that make Nail way older than our other heralds or not?
I mean, there was a time jump.
Yes,
from 100 to 104. Yeah, so we're now 8,000 years ago, which
I guess the answer is no. Yeah, you're correct. The answer is no. That doesn't make him super a ton older. Okay, fair enough. Anything else from our first two Tanavast point of view?
I'm very curious for more. Very curious for more. And I'm hoping, well, not hoping necessarily, I'm expecting this is going to lead into and culminate in the destruction of Honor, the death of Tanavast.
Yeah.
I think you're right, Elliot. I think that's where we're headed. One thing I'm curious about is if we keep getting this, won't we get something related to the Stormfather as well? I don't know if it's something that Dalinar will know, but maybe we, the reader, may understand other information about the Stormfather. I don't know if that will be the case. I'm not going to bank on that. But I of course, think of Tanavast, Honor, Stormfather as being in the boat together, you know?
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm waiting for. No other thoughts to add or takeaways other than I am so excited we are getting this. It's just such a cool point of view to get. It feels like a gift. It feels like a blessing to get to read these perspectives, which is so exciting.
Who knew that day 9 was Christmas morning on Roshar? All right. Chapter 101. Venli and Leshwe are still debating amongst themselves whether to take L's offer. And Leshwe seems way more into it than Venli does. And Venli, by the end of the chapter, by the end of 103, actually, gives Sigzil a message of like, hey, we could join you or something like that. And Sigzil seems to kind of brush it off. What'd you guys think of this?
Yeah, I got really excited about this because ever since I knew that Rhythm of War was going to be Venli's book, I've been waiting for the moment that she connects with our other characters. And that hasn't been very much at all.
Yeah.
So this felt like that. It felt like we're starting to connect that dot into the rest of our story. And I am so excited. I really want Venli to get in the room with our other characters and what kind of conversations and what kind of things that could be learned could happen. So I'm really banking for this. I'm really, really hoping that this keeps going through. I really happen to like these two, Venli and Leshwe. It's still crazy to me that Leshwe is on our side.
Yeah.
That was like one of the craziest reveals on the side of the Knights Radiant. But yeah, I anticipate that this will work out and they will be connected at some point. And I don't know where that thread goes exactly. I have a feeling that it's going to tie in some really crazy, magnificent way. Brandon will tie this into, I don't know, somehow with Bite or Mishram or the challenge or what, but I think I've been waiting for their part to play out in this story, and I hope that's where we're headed.
No, we get the majority of chapter 101 with Navani, actually, and I thought this passage was actually kind of fascinating. Navani gets two, maybe three different flashback visions that are sent to her, and she's in control enough to realize that whatever is sending me this isn't actually here. This is like a pre-recorded like message sent to me. Like Taravangian is off doing his thing with Yasna and Dalinar, and Navani's like kind of, you know, waving her hand in front of the vision and nothing's happening to it. So she actually, the title of the chapter is Steering a Troll, and the troll is the vision to her. And she now she's like kind of guiding the vision where she expects it to go, and has way more control than certainly Shallan, maybe Dalinar, over these visions that are happening. I thought this was interesting.
This was an interesting chapter. I have two major thoughts about this. First of all, main thought, Gavilar is still the worst. Can't stand that guy.
Gavilar is still the worst.
Absolutely the worst. That was like my main thought through this.
He's been dead for 5 books now and he's still the worst.
Still the worst, absolutely. Has yet to have any redemptive qualities. Second thought is, this is not a bad thing. I don't want this to sound like a bad thing, but I feel like we're playing catch up on Navani's development and flashback. Is this the first specifically like Navani flashback we've gotten, unless you count the prologue that she's a part of? I don't remember there being other Navani flashbacks, but we get that here where she talks about her husband and lots of other people and things like that. We get that perspective for her. And I felt kind of dumb. I was like, why haven't we gotten this yet? I haven't even like considered. And she's one of our bondsmiths, a major player in our story, which to be fair, her being a bondsmith is new. Like that is like 9 days old or something like that, roughly. So like that's new. So there's not been a ton of time for that to play out. Except she is running on double time, right? We can remember she doesn't have to sleep.
True.
But anyways, I feel like we're playing catch up with Navani's character, trying to establish her more. I'm all for it. I really like Navani. I almost expected this type of moment to be like in the time frame where instead getting character development for Yonagon, you know, like I feel like there's a lot of threads going on. I love Yonagon. I've absolutely loved that part of the story. But yeah, I couldn't help but think we're too late to getting these Navani flashbacks and growing out her character more.
Kind of in that same thought line, this kind of made me a little bit sad. I posted about this in the live reaction Discord channel for our patrons. This this flashback has me rather intrigued, actually. Surprise is Navani comes from a humble background. She doesn't come from aristocracy. She comes from kind of a ranch where they're just raising animals. So how did she get connected with Gavilar? How did that marriage happen? Gavilar is all big about like the big connections. Like the fight they're having is about how Elokar has to marry Aes Sedain and not the lowly scribe or whatever. Right. So what's the backstory here on Navani? And then I got to thinking, we may never get that, because Navani is not a future like flashback POV that we know of. Now, there's a lot of ways that could get worked in somewhere in the future. Yasna is going to be a POV, could be part of that, maybe, perhaps. But I think we've already had the Navani book. So are we not ever going to get this? That makes me a little sad.
We've got one more day.
Okay, that's true.
we still got one more day. It's not hopeless, but yeah, I see what you mean, Elliot. And that was some of my thoughts as well. I don't want that to sound, like I said, don't take it the wrong way when I said it feels a bit late. I don't want it to seem like her character hasn't been good. Obviously, it's been good. I just am realizing I feel like her history and her context as a character hasn't been fleshed out. There's not been much attention to it. But all in all, like, this was a beautiful chapter, well written. Like Trevor mentioned, I liked the allegory of her steering the Chul right through this vision. I thought it was really cool.
On to 102, which I thought was one of the more interesting chapters we've had on a Zeth flashback. He's listening in on Sivvy and Posen. And Posen is his like arch rival honor bearer guy. And Posen says everything's under control, or at least that's what the voice says. But don't worry about Zeth. We've got him covered. And Sivvy's the one that he's actually here for. Sivvy's the one on the fence between Zeth and Posen. Zeth shows up and tries to maybe win Sivvy over, but then it doesn't go well. Posen shows up and draws his sword, which causes Zeth to flee. And now I'm trying to think back to the beginning of this book, which for us was 6 months ago. Are these two of the current honor bearers that we fought on the way here?
So we fought Posen because he's the one who sucked him into Shadesmar and then killed himself and says, ha ha, get out now. That was Posen. Right.
Yes.
Sivvy is Edge Dancer, I think. And I think when we got to the Edge Dancer one, he goes in and he says something like, oh, you're not Sivvy. Did Sivvy die? And the person was like, yes, Sivvy died. You have to fight me.
Okay.
I think is how I remember. I might be wrong on that.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. Did you guys get anything out of this chapter?
So this is the one I want to ask you guys about, because Sivvy says something kind of weird here. So just like you were saying, Zeth is listening in, but then Zeth confronts Sivvy first and they're talking. And Zeth is like, you know, I saw the Unmaid. How are you serving this? And yeah, here we go. Let me, I'll just read it. This is starting with Zeth. How could you serve one of the Unmaid? She sighed. You saw the captive Spren then? Captive and being tortured. I had hoped he'd come to you outside the cavern, she said. That was how he spoke to me first. I demanded the full truth. Then you got angry when he gave it to you? Sivvy, this is what we trained to fight. The Unmaid's presence means the desolation has begun. The world's in danger and we're not ready to fight it. Wait, Sivvy said. What did you see, Zeth? She frowned, her eyes distant. Could I? Could that be right? Could I have been deceived? That's the form I'd have chosen for a deception. But Zeth, it's not. And then Posen interrupts at that point. What is Sivvy talking about? That doesn't even... I'm very confused.
The dialogue doesn't even make sense. Like,
I was also confused by this and not 100% certain I'm expecting this is one of those that we might comically open the next chapter and find out, like the next Zeth flashback we get to finish that dialogue or something like that, or some realization. But yeah, I'm not certain about this. I am under the impression, obviously, a lot of these characters have been influenced by the voice, our unmade friend here. And we through Zeth's eyes, saw this area. And obviously, you get the heebie-jeebies and get out of there. I should be, these other characters saw that too, but were in some way convinced that's okay, or that things are okay, that's not a problem. Obviously, deception is going deep here, but I don't have anything other than that there's some really deep deception going on here, and perhaps Civi is realizing that.
The dialogue to me felt like she wasn't even really having a conversation with Zeth anymore. She was like having a lucid moment in a trance or something like that. But it had more the vibe of Ishar as Navani swore her ideal of like, this is the real me. I'm talking to you really quickly and I'm gone. That's more the vibe I had than, which makes me think, did current day Civi like flee? If you're right, Elliot, and if the Edge Dancer claimed that Civi was dead or whatever, and I'm now the Edge Dancer honor bearer, I'm wondering if current day Civi got out, like, or maybe died after Zeth leaves, or is named Truthless, or whatever is going to happen here.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to take that. She just goes all weird for a second, and it's odd because at the start of the conversation, it's almost like she knows. She's like, oh, you saw the captive Spren then? Which makes it seem like Civi knows that this is an unmade, knows that the unmade is torturing Spren, knows the dark side. But then the end of it almost seems like maybe Civi doesn't know. And it's like, oh, that's a deception. Almost like it's a light bulb moment maybe for Civi. Like, is there another twist yet to come? Is what Zeth saw not real? I don't know. This has got me.
You cut out there, so I don't know what it has you. But in the end of 102, I think that I think Civi's going to show up in our current day Zeth alive. That's my prediction. I think Zeth got through to Civi here, and it'll turn up that Civi's actually like got out of Shinnevar successfully.
Civi maybe showing up, or some other twist is what I was referring to a second ago. Could there be another surprise waiting for us here of what Zeth saw was somehow not reality? I'm going to have my eyes open as we go forward.
All right. And to wrap it up, we have the first half of 103. We talked about the Sigzil section already. The Wind is still trying to convince Kaladin to give Nail a chance. And Kaladin is cooking carrots for breakfast. Oh, and we're about to go fight Nail in his monastery.
We're about to go fight Nail in his monastery, which they're very apprehensive about, understandably. And then the Wind has Kaladin commune with the stone he's sitting on and learns that it used to be a giant statue.
Yeah.
Which the whole section was like, okay, this is kind of cool. I don't know how this is relevant, but cool.
That's all I got. Do you guys have anything else?
Not really. There's a lot to this chapter, this episode for sure. I'm confident there's other things that could be talked about, that there's things we missed, because there's just so much going on at this point. But man, if there isn't so much going on right now,
we are setting up a lot for day 9 and of course day 10. So here we go. Buckle up.
Yeah, I was going to say the end of chapter 104. Hold on. Hold that thought. There's still like 14 hours left in this book and we're in chapter 104. we're closing in, but it's still a couple laps to go still. Anyway, we can reconvene next week with 105 through 108 for episode 262. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
Laters.
Toodles. See you next week.